Hello and welcome back to First Pages Readings, where books are celebrated as cultural messengers. And thanks for joining me. Today's episode features nonfiction books from an author born in Somalia, an author from Syria, and an author who has dedicated her life's work to studying and writing about ancient Rome. Today's first book is The Last Nomad, Coming of Age in the Somali Desert, by Shugri Saidsal. With picturesque and descriptive language, the book covers the author's journey from a young girl who was sent to live with her grandmother in the desert, where she lived a nomadic life, to being displaced by the Somali Civil War, then living in a refugee camp, and ultimately emigrating to North America. The book opens a window to a world most of us don't know, and while the story describes the author's tumultuous journey of hardship, it also reveals a story of resilience and survival and eventual contentment. This is a heartbreaking but beautiful book. From the prologue of The Last Nomad. I am the last nomad. How can I be the last one? Nomads still exist in that faraway desert where I grew up. So how can I make such a bold statement? What I am really trying to say is, I am the last person in my direct line to have once lived like that, and now I feel like the sole keeper of my family's stories. As I sit here in my home in California, weaving my tale for you, the weight of that responsibility urges me on. All of my ancestors on both sides of my family were nomads. They traveled the East African desert in search of grazing land for their livestock, and the most precious resource of all, water. When they exhausted the land and the clouds disappeared from the horizon, their accumulated ancestral knowledge told them where to move next to find greener pastures. They loaded their huts and belongings onto their most obedient camels and herded their livestock to a new home. My nomadic family was at the mercy of the weather at the end of Gyal, the long dry season. When the clouds finally rumbled with rain, we looked up at the sky with renewed hope. As the desert quenched its thirst, the red earth crackled back to life. Responsibility eased. Adults welcomed the rain with drums, singing, and dancing. Children got fat and healthy. Sitting around the fire at night, they soaked in the folk tales and poems passed down from generation to generation. But despite the renewed abundance of food, we knew we had to preserve some of it for the dry season to follow. Sometimes the drought hit harder than usual, killing both livestock and people. Bones and twigs soon littered the terrain where goats and sheep once happily grazed. In those times, my ancestors ceased singing under the moon, their drums hardened, and they longed for good news. Children no longer heard stories by the fire, and an old poet would bellow to the desert, voicing his agony. He would speak of a dying land taking his precious camels. His mournful poem would then travel through time and across borders to remedy the pain of his people for years to come. My three children, raised in California, know nothing of nomadic life, except from the stories I have shared. As I sit here now in my comfortable suburban home, listening to my teenage son excitedly tell me about his favorite YouTuber, I am reminded acutely of the void between my past and my present. Today's second book is The Pianist from Syria, a memoir by Ahem Ahmad, and translated by Emmanuel Bergman. The book begins in Damascus, Syria, and recounts the author's story as part of a Palestinian minority community who seeks refuge from the Syrian revolution. Escaping to Germany, he begins to perform and teach music while he continues to work toward reuniting his family, who remain in Syria. The story of survival and triumph is a valuable resource in learning about and understanding the struggles and tragedies in this region. The first pages of the prologue of The Pianist from Syria. A photo can never really tell you what happened before or what came after. Like that picture of me sitting at a piano, singing a song amid the rubble of my neighborhood. It was reprinted by newspapers all over the world, and some people said it's one of the photos that will help us remember the Syrian Civil War. An image larger than war. But when I think back to that moment, I think of another image, superimposed on all the rest, an image of three birds. That morning before daybreak, I had gone out for water, together with my friends Marwan and Rayed. Getting water was backbreaking work. We had to rise early and push a 260-gallon tank on a cart to one of the last working pipes in the neighborhood, then fill up the tank and push it back home. We lived in Yarmouk, a suburb of Damascus. The armies of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad had cut us off from the rest of the world. We had no water, no electricity, no bread, no rice. By that time, more than 100 people had died of starvation. After my friends and I had delivered the water to our street, I decided to get some more sleep. But a little while later, my 2-year-old son, Ahmad, whispering something in my ear, and then playfully poked his tiny finger into my eye. Ouch! I jumped out of bed. Clearly, I wasn't going to get any more rest. I decided to heat up some water with cinnamon. We had run out of coffee and tea a long time ago. But there was plenty of cinnamon, ever since a group of militants had stormed a local spice depot. It hadn't seemed like such a bad haul at first. All this cinnamon. But think about it. Who needs cinnamon when you don't even have bread or sugar? That's why it was ridiculously cheap. Several months earlier, a few young men from the neighborhood had started a music group. We had been performing out in the streets, standing around my upright piano. Every day, we hauled it out on a cart, carefully steering it through the rubble. We sang to escape the ever-present hunger that was gnawing at us. Our performances were popular on YouTube, but the people in my neighborhood could barely be bothered. And who can blame them? When you're hungry, you can't think about anything else. On that day, the two of us had agreed to meet with a photographer named Niraz Saeed. Marwan and I began pushing the piano, which was unbelievably heavy. Usually there were 6 or 7 of us carefully maneuvering it through the torn-up streets. We turned onto Palestine Street, which had once been a bustling commercial center and was now deserted. The damage was staggering. The ruined buildings were like concrete skeletons, giant tombstones reaching into the sky. Entire walls had been torn off, revealing the insides of various apartments, with pipes and cables sticking out. The street was littered with heaps of rubble, with weeds growing among them. I sat down at the piano and thought about what I should sing. I had written dozens of songs in the past few months. They had simply poured out of me. Then I remembered a poem, scribbled on a piece of paper that a man had given me a few days earlier. His name was Ziad al-Karaf. In the old days, he sold honey in our neighborhood. He was very cultured and educated, and he used to be quite wealthy. I knew him only in passing. Ziad had a doctorate, but I don't know in what. I do know that the honey was merely his hobby. He used to take trips to the hills outside of town to meet with local beekeepers. Sometimes he even went abroad to countries like Yemen, where he would sample new blends of honey. But that was then, before the war. Today's third book is A Rome of One's Own: The Forgotten Women of the Roman Empire by Emma Southen. This book is hard to put down, as it asks us to reconsider how we learn and think about history. The stories of over 20 women are told, expanding our awareness of ancient Rome. The book includes a diverse selection of women from different backgrounds and social standings. It's scholarly and entertaining, humorous at times, while it tells the stories of women who lived independent lives under the control of emperors, women who led armies against those emperors, who created art, and women who in general define their life's course in spite of highly regulated gender norms. A Rome of One's Own reveals an original account of the ancient world by featuring women who were generally disregarded and misunderstood. A few pages from the introduction of A Rome of One's Own. There is a story from the 1970s, often told by Roman historians of gender. It goes like this. Students at an American college approached their male professor, a revered Roman historian, to request a course on women in Roman history. They being among the first women ever to study ancient history at this university, wanted to see themselves on their syllabus. Their professor disagreed. To their dismay, he replied that he may as well do a course on Roman dogs. The professor's meaning was clear. Women have no place in history. History is not about women or children or non-binary people or indeed dogs. History to him and to an awful lot of people is the doing of important things. It is winning battles and having important opinions in public. History is politics and public deeds. Women don't make history. The history of the Roman Empire is usually told in this mold. It starts with Romulus, moves through Brutus, overthrowing Tarquin, bounces through an appallingly tedious list of expansionist battles and generals and consuls, before merging into the political stab fest of the late Republic. From there, it runs through all the emperors, occasionally mentioning a wife or mother to show how badly things can go when women take control, until Constantine invents Christianity, and then Attila the Hun rolls up and ruins it. But the history of Rome and its empire is so much more than just emperors and politicians and generals. History is so much more than important things. You and I right now are living through history. In the future, history books will be written about the times we live in, and we won't be in them because we mostly do not do important things. History, though, still includes us. It includes women who are not prime ministers or queens or capital I important. History happens to women and men as much as they make it. This book, then, is a revisionist history of the Roman Empire with important things relegated to the background. This is a history of the things the Roman male historians and biographers never wanted to write about and certainly didn't want us to be writing about. This is a history of the things the Roman history writers designated as domestic, feminine, boring, and worthless. It is a history of individuals, because, to quote Svetlana Alekhevich, this miniature expanse, one person, the individual, it's where everything really happens. This is a history of Rome from its foundation in 753 BCE to the fall of the last Western Roman emperor in 476 CE, through the lives of women you have probably never heard of. These women are vestal virgins and sex workers. They are business owners and poets, martyrs and saints. Only four are rulers or officially involved in important things. Each of them tells a different story of the Roman Empire as it grew from belligerent city-state to immense empire and then shrank into warring states, from polytheistic republic to emperor-worshipping monarchy to Christian superpower. By focusing on women, we discover a whole new history of the Roman Empire, one where marriage is as important as war, and where what it is to be Roman is constantly being reassessed. Many of the women in this book never set foot in Italy, let alone Rome. Several considered themselves to be enemies of the Romans. Others considered themselves thoroughly Roman, but were treated as enemies. Including women in history forces us, as historians, to reevaluate what a Roman was, what Romanness was, and to confront the immense scope of the Roman Empire. Including women deepens our understanding of Roman history and Roman life. When Romulus founded Rome, he knew that his city would not be complete until it included women. The history of Rome is equally incomplete without them. Thank you for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed hearing about these books.